Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Northern California wildfires have shocked Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino, Yuba counties. Flames that ignited early Monday morning while people were in bed and then wind-whipped through dry brush and wooden track developments. At least 11 are dead. More than 20,000 have been evacuated. Shirley Zane is supervisor for District 3 in Sonoma County. She's in Santa Rosa on one of the few working landlines. Supervisor Zane, Shirley, I understand you flew over the burn area in a helicopter. What did you see?
I did. I saw devastation everywhere. I saw thousands of homes that have been lost, and it literally leveled. We have a neighborhood in Santa Rosa where a lot of hardworking middle-class people live called Coffee Park, and that neighborhood was just simply leveled. We have literally overnight displaced thousands of people with these infernos and hellish fires. And I was with Congressman Thompson, who we were both trying to get as many photos as we could and just to really assess the damage, because he's, of course, going to go to work for us with FEMA back in Washington. You know, he's a Vietnam vet. And I kept looking at him saying, this looks like a war zone. And he would nod. It was just awful. And not only that, but we didn't just see neighborhoods that were simply leveled, but we also saw fires sprouting up where we flew, you know, not too far from them. You know, this morning it's humid, it's cool, that we have our marine layer, but what's happened now is that particulate matter that gets in the air because of wood smoke, it has just come down upon us, and it's, when you step outside, it's like you put your head in a chimney. It's so devastating, I can't, you know, even begin to tell you how devastating it is. They did kill at least 7 people, but it's probably going to be quite a bit more. We had to evacuate mobile home parks and assisted livings and residential care. And so sometimes it's hard for seniors to get out. And hopefully we got everybody out, but we won't know until we can go in and assess the damage.
Well, you say 7 dead. That's there. People have been killed, you know, elsewhere by this fire, too. I mean, the toll is going to rise, as you said.
It's definitely going to rise. We're estimating right now that there's been about 1,500 structures. And when I say structures, I'm talking about schools. And I'm talking about large Kmarts and the Performance Arts Theater. They've been leveled also. So it amazingly didn't just hit these neighborhoods, but it hit a lot of businesses as well.
Well, we're reading half of Cardinal Newman High destroyed. You've got the Fountain Grove Inn, the Hilton Sonoma Wine Country, the historic
hotel.
Fountain Grove.
Normally that hotel would have housed a great deal of people that were displaced, but the hotel just burned down flat.
We tend to have in our mind's eye, when we hear about wildfires, we have a sense that maybe there are a few homes in remote areas in the mountaintop. These are neighborhoods, tracts of homes. These are block after block of houses. Not remote.
Yeah, no, not remote at all. I think I was talking to some of the firefighters yesterday, and they had fought the Lake County fires, and they said that these are so much worse because with the Lake County fires, and Lake County is just northeast of us, it was more acreage and less homes. And with these fires, it just leveled urban neighborhoods. The urban nature of this fire and how fast it swept through us is just amazing. And we need help from everybody. The Red Cross is, of course, doing their job. I can tell you that we're such a generous and resilient county. We sent teams down to Houston and Hurricane Irma, and I was telling my assistant the other day, I think I need to volunteer for Red Cross to go do some supportive work in terms of my background as a therapist and a chaplain to some of these areas, and because I speak Spanish. And you know what? I've got my work cut out for me right here. There is so much grief out there right now, if you can imagine. Thousands of people losing their homes, everything overnight. The county is the largest employer. We have over 4,000 employees, And we had a lot of employees that lost their homes.
Mm. And you've got to, you know, get back to work. You got to stand up. So,
yep, got to stand up.
Yep.
That's right.
Shirley Zane, county supervisor there in Sonoma County, with us from Santa Rosa. The horrific news coming out of that area after the wildfires. Supervisor Zane, Shirley, thank you so much, and best to you. Best to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, President Trump responded today to Senator Bob Corker's fear that the president is leading the U.S. on a path to World War III. Trump said, "We're on the right path now," and he said he doesn't think his back and forth with Corker is going to imperil his tax overhaul. Joining us now is NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, lots to get to here, but start with the president's continued attacks on Senator Bob Corker, who he now calls on Twitter Little Bob Corker. He's the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. Can President Trump afford to alienate him if he wants tax cuts passed?
Well, it's hard for President Trump to be able to alienate any Republican in the Senate and hope to pass anything because they only have 52 votes. Losing Corker would mean that much narrower of a possibility there. And he's been critical of the tax plan. He's on the budget committee. So the president and Senator Corker now getting into a big back and forth. And Corker himself said that the White House has become like an adult daycare center and somebody must have missed their shift.
And is there a sense that there's a strategy here on the part of the president or this is just personal?
No, there's no sense that there's real strategy, you know, but I don't think that that means that there's inconsistency. I think that if you look at President Trump before he was President Trump, it all fits with his character. If you attack him, he's going to attack back. And this came after Corker's interview with The New York Times, where he decided to say that the president was potentially taking the country on the path to World War III.
All right. Meanwhile, the EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, has now proposed the repeal of the Clean Power Plan today. That's the Obama era regulation to reduce emissions and move away from coal powered plants. Here's Pruitt explaining why.
And I'll tell you, when you think about what that rule meant, that rule really was about picking winners and losers. The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country. And that's wrong.
Now, the Clean Power Plan was never even fully implemented. And many experts would say that the reason that coal is declining in this country has more to do with economic conditions than federal policies. But why is the Trump administration proposing the repeal of the Clean Power Plan?
Well, the coal industry certainly would benefit from this. And Scott Pruitt, you realize, was somebody who had sued this federal government over the Clean Power Plan, being from Oklahoma, and was a main opponent of the EPA. So this is not that surprising, given President Trump's promises to coal country and the coal industry. And when you work in the coal industry and maybe you've lost a job because of what they feel are excess regulations, then you're not as concerned about health and welfare of the environment, for example.
The White House, meanwhile, released a list of demands to Congress on immigration that includes measures that would be unpalatable to Democrats, funding a border wall, tightening immigration laws, and cracking down on sanctuary cities. Is that the end of that deal that Trump made with Democratic leaders last month in order to provide a pathway for DACA recipients?
I'd say this is more a starting point. This is probably President Trump coming forward the way he, you know, might say to somebody, you know, I'm going to pay you half for building that clubhouse and kind of come forward with a giant ask and then potentially walk it back. You know, he's insisting that the wall be in this, but will he do that? You know, there have been several walkbacks of the wall being part of it. And remember, he told the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, you know, I know you're not going to pay for it. Just don't talk about it. And I think that this may be another situation like that. And if it's not, they may have some trouble getting Democrats on board.
You could end up with no deal at all.
Totally.
Trump also tweeted this morning that since Congress can't get its act together on health care, I will be using the power of the pen to give great health care to many people fast. What does he mean?
Well, he wants to try to let people buy health care across state lines, though if you had a federal exchange, state lines wouldn't really matter, of course, Jeremy.
Right. Exactly. But we don't know what he's planning to do here.
No, it's expected that sometime this week he will try to possibly sign an executive order that would say that they allow folks to buy health insurance across state lines.
All right. One more thing, Domenico. Dianne Feinstein, the Democratic senator from California, announced she is running again in 2020. That would be her sixth term. by the end of which she would be 91 years old. She was challenged on whether Californians want to see her run again on NBC's Meet the Press. Here she is.
I'm ready for a good fight. I've got things to fight for. I'm in a position where I can be effective, and hopefully that means something to California.
Domenico, is it unusual for someone of Feinstein's age to announce a re-election campaign, and do you expect her to encounter resistance from her own party?
Well, she won't be 91 when she starts running.
She's 84 now.
End of that term, right. Yeah. And there have been plenty of men who have run and at a elevated age of 80 or higher, where they've been in the Senate. You think about someone like Strom Thurmond or Robert Byrd,
right.
People like that. So, I would expect a hotly contested Democratic primary, but ironically, in this super progressive state, because of the mechanics of the primary there, Feinstein might be in a very strong position and be difficult to beat. Even if the progressive candidate makes the final round, she could win with Republican and independent votes, people who might be a little leery of a super progressive candidate.
That's NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome as always.
CVS recently announced it will limit opioid prescriptions to 7 days in an attempt to fight abuse. Are there other solutions to the raging opioid epidemic? At Seattle's Harborview Hospital, Tim Clark has been taking pain pills, opioids, because of debilitating and crippling neuropathic pain from the Guillain-Barré syndrome.
So why wouldn't I be depressed? But the opioids make it worse. And, I get in a real funk. If I can cut back on them even a little bit, I seem to have a more positive attitude.
So he's trying to cut back with hypnosis to reprogram his brain. And the center is also using virtual reality simulators. So reporter Miles O'Brien tried one for himself. You might remember we spoke with Miles about losing his arm in an accident while reporting in Japan 3 years ago. Some heavy equipment fell on him. So he's no stranger to chronic and phantom pain. Miles is a science, technology, aviation, and space journalist. He reported this pain treatment story for the PBS NewsHour series on the opioid crisis. He joins us. And Miles, so nice to speak with you again.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
So talk first about what we're talking about here. You met people with tremendous pain.
Yeah, I learned a little bit about the differentiation between acute and chronic pain. And it's a very important distinction. Acute pain is something that is all about survival for us. We stub our toe or something worse, and it's nature's way of telling you to stop doing that. You're going to get yourself in further trouble. Acute pain, by definition in the medical textbooks, lasts about 90 days. That's generally what the medical community would say it would take to heal most any part of the body that has been injured. After that 90-day period, we get into what is called chronic pain, and that is when it's more of a top-down situation. There's no sensory input coming from the body to the brain, but rather the brain is indicating there's pain with none of those inputs. And that is a really challenging problem for the medical community.
Right. That's worth repeating. Acute pain is tissue damage, the body sending the pain signal to the brain, we're hurt. Chronic pain is more often the brain sending the pain signal to the body. It may not be related to tissue pain. Talk about what opioids do to block those messages of pain.
Opioids are the best pain reliever that medicine can offer us. And the reason is they mimic what our body does. We have naturally occurring opioids in our body. We all know the term runner's high. Endorphins kick in after a run, kicks in the dopamine in our brain, which is the pleasure drug that our body creates, gives us a feeling of euphoria, and we become relaxed. Well, that's opioids in our system doing their work. We don't have enough capability within our system to manage acute pain in that manner. So by putting synthetic opioids in our body, we flood the system and we create an awful lot of dopamine and we address pain. But there's all kinds of consequences to that that are well documented, as
right.
you know.
Well, and you remind us of the history of opioid pain medication starting back in the Civil War. Morphine was used on soldiers, but they became addicted, so it fell out of favor. Then in 1980, there was a letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine about a study that claimed a very small amount of opioid users actually became addicted. As you point out, this was not peer-reviewed, and yet this thinking took off because, of course, the pharmaceutical industry jumped on that. Talk about these virtual reality games that the creators are suggesting people might play while they're in pain. What are we picturing?
Well, so in this case, what they've developed at UW Medicine in Seattle at Harborview Medical Center is an immersive game. It's kind of a silly game called Snow World, but it's engrossing enough and yet simple. And once you're inside this virtual reality environment, you're determined to throw snowballs at penguins. That's what it is. And you get very focused and wrapped up in this game. And I talked to a burn victim. He had terrible second-degree burns over a good hunk of his body, a grease fire in a kitchen. And when they do the treatment of his wounds, called debridement, it's a horribly painful technique that is used to treat burn victims, almost as painful as the burn itself. He takes opioids because that's such acute pain. But on top of it, they put him in this virtual reality world, and he's not communicating with his pain, engaged with his pain in the same way. It takes you to another place, quite literally.
Well, and this is someone, as you said, who has this acute pain now from having bandages changed. And we should be more clear that burn victims go through this horrible process where their raw burns are actually scrubbed. It has to happen. And it's excruciating. And this virtual reality game alleviated that pain. Let's listen.
I could tell that they were peeling off a bandage. And I remember actually thinking in my head, you know, this should hurt a bit more. But I was focused on the game because I was trying to shoot a penguin and not really worrying so much about them taking my dressing off.
A burn victim talking about wearing a virtual reality headset and playing a game while he's being treated. In the PBS series about the opioid crisis, America Addicted, reporter Miles O'Brien is with us. Now we come to you, Miles O'Brien. Here you are with chronic pain. It's been 3 years since you lost your arm, but also phantom pain. Describe that.
Well, phantom pain is a classic example of chronic pain, top-down pain. We can say absolutely empirically that my arm is missing, and so to say it's in pain doesn't make much sense, right? So clearly my brain has got something going on here. My brain has a disconnect. There's a lot of theories on why this happens, but the brain, for whatever reason, detects something missing and creates a pain response to it. So anyway, the idea was to put me in this snow world and test my reaction to an acute pain situation. They actually set it up with a little heater. They attach this thing to my wrist, and I get inside Snow World, and I start throwing snowballs, and they start dialing up the heat on my wrist. I didn't feel that a bit. But the most interesting thing to me and to the researcher who I was with was my phantom pain completely disappeared. And what I realized in that moment, and what was further explained to me by the researcher, Hunter Hoffman, is that pain needs an audience. If you're not there to receive it, there is no such thing as pain. This is why general anesthesia works. You're asleep. You don't feel pain. So if you're not engaged with it, if you're not focused on it in some way, it was remarkable to me how suddenly that was not a part of my existence, that pain.
So, Miles, this idea that it blocked not just the pain they were inflicting on you with this heat, which is coming into you, but they blocked the pain which is going out as a signal from your brain. It's a first.
The researcher had not experienced this. He hadn't tested for it either. Yeah. He has been focused on acute pain, bottom-up pain. But there I was. He was looking ostensibly at the issue of bottom-up pain, but I'm a guy who walks in with my own top-down problems. And sure enough, it affected it. And so it's a very promising area of research because on the one hand, this was a temporary thing. You know, the minute I came out of Snow World, I was back to my old self. However, the thinking is that over time, maybe you can rewire, for lack of a better term, the brain, teach it to think differently, teach it to address pain in a different way, and maybe address chronic pain in a different way. It's, you know, the important thing to remember is, you know, I think Americans, we look for a silver bullet solution. We want to take a pill and make it go away. And pain is something that you have to have a lot of tools in the toolbox. Sometimes it might be opioids. Sometimes it might be mindfulness therapy or hypnosis. And sometimes it might be Snow World.
And we want to make that clear that, you know, we always hear from people in terrible pain, you know, afraid that people are going to do away with opioids because of the crisis. But yeah, it sounds as if that's what needs to happen, to figure out a way to do what pain blockers, either the pills or this virtual reality, what they do, which is somehow trick your brain.
It's important that the medical community start thinking about this differently. You know, most doctors are not really trained to treat pain as an affliction itself. It's treated as a symptom of something else. Pain is an entity unto itself, and medicine needs to address that. And then, of course, you have a system where your doctor gets about 6 minutes with you, and how on earth is he going to really address the nuance of what we just discussed when it's a lot easier to hand out some script for, you know, some Vicodin and send the patient on his way. So the system needs to rethink this. It's happening now because of the crisis that we're dealing with. But it's very important that we think about pain and all its nuance, I think.
Well, Miles O'Brien, you have a lot of fans. And so just want to check in. How often do you have this phantom pain?
You know, Rob and I live with it every day, and it waxes and wanes throughout the day. I always have the phantom sensation of the arm, and sometimes it's bothersome and sometimes it's not. And frankly, the times that it bothers me is when I'm just sitting on an airplane, as I do a lot, and I'm not focused on something else. But if I'm engaged in what I love to do, my work, or I'm out on a bike ride having fun or a run, it goes away. So that just further buttresses the point that it is a little bit about focus, about giving it an audience. And I'm doing my best to ignore it along the way, but sometimes it's unavoidable.
How much did you want to take that virtual reality mask that, you know, inside was were the penguins? How much did you want to take that with you?
If I could have Snow World at home, I would be using it. I really would. And there are other virtual reality approaches and software. Maybe I should just get myself a headset.
Yeah. Miles O'Brien, science, technology, aviation, space journalist, his piece on virtual reality as treatment for pain, but also maybe part of the search for blocking pain, aired on the PBS NewsHour. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Miles, thanks as always.
You are so welcome, Robin.
And a 2011 study from the military showed that Snow World, created by the University of Washington, helped soldiers with burn injuries from IEDs. In fact, Snow World worked better than morphine. The University of Louisiana uses this virtual reality to help people deal with phobias like fears of flying. Georgia Tech released something called the Virtual Vietnam VR in 1997 to help veterans with PTSD. Now Miles says it's blocked his chronic pain. Have you used it? Share your story at hereandnow.org.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at WBUR.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcasts. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
Investigators in Las Vegas say that 9 days after the shooting there, they still don't know what motivated the shooter, Stephen Paddock. Here's Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo.
Yes, I'm frustrated. If you look in the public media, perception that I am frustrated at the speed of this investigation, yes, I am. It isn't because nobody is not doing their job. It's because this individual purposely hid his actions leading up to this event, and it is difficult for us to find the answers to those actions.
But the sheriff did offer a few new pieces of information, and joining us now is Casey Morell of KNPR in Las Vegas. Casey, first of all, we're learning more about the timeline of events the night of the shooting. Originally, police said that a hotel security guard at Mandalay Bay had been shot in the hallway outside the shooter's room after he had fired on the concert, but now we're hearing the security guard was shot beforehand.
Yeah, Jeremy, we've had some changes to the timeline of events. Jesus Campos, the security guard in question, Metro Police now say he was shot at 9:59 p.m. that Sunday night. The first gunshots coming out into the crowd were 6 minutes later at 10:05.
And do we know what he did in those 6 minutes? Obviously, he'd just been shot, but was he able to alert the hotel or police?
Well, we're not exactly sure. Police have not said whether Campos, who is currently recovering in a hospital after being shot, they have not said if he alerted casino security. But police have said that they didn't know that Campos was shot until they saw him in person, when they were able to come up onto the hallway in the 32nd floor and saw that he had been attacked in this incident.
What's the latest more broadly on the investigation?
Sure. So police are still talking to Stephen Paddock's brother, Eric, and to Paddock's girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, to try and figure out just what transpired. Eric Paddock has told media that his brother enjoyed coming to Las Vegas and liked being treated as a high roller. Police just yesterday said that they found 200 different instances of Paddock on surveillance tapes before the attack. Anybody who's been to Las Vegas knows that cameras are everywhere. Right. So being able to see him in the run up to the event, you know, they were able to do that quite easily. But they said that no one was ever seen with him. There was no one traveling with him. They didn't see any type of accomplice or anyone around him. This is, at least according to Metro, helping put to bed the idea of a second gunman that circulated immediately after the shooting, or any kind of accomplice that may have assisted Paddock during the attack.
So no one with him, but he spent a lot of time in those casinos and gambled an awful lot of money.
Yeah, he was something of a high roller, at least that's what he liked to think of himself as. There's testimony from Paddock in a court case back in 2013. He had a lawsuit against the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas, which is another hotel here on the Strip. And in that testimony, he said that he would bet up to $1 million some nights, and that gambling was getting him comped rooms and food across the Strip, and that was part of the reason why he was doing it. So he was definitely someone who liked to gamble. Reports say that video poker was his game of choice.
But still no indication of a motive.
No, not at all. You know, we know Metro has been very methodical about all of this. They want all the T's crossed and I's dotted before giving any kind of answer. So if they have any leads, they haven't shared them yet.
That's Casey Morell at KNPR in Las Vegas. And we'll continue to follow the latest on the investigation into the shooting there. Casey, thank you.
Always.
$50,000 a year. That's now the cost of tuition and fees at some private K-12 schools in New York City. That's more than many people pay to send their kids to a private school for college. So what accounts for that high cost, and are the advantages of private school worth it? Joining us now is Pearl Kane, who's a professor and the director of the Klingenstein Center at Teachers College at Columbia University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Hello to you.
So when you look across the country, what is the average cost of the average private school at this point?
Well, I think New York and some of the large urban areas are anomalies. Across the country, the cost of tuition is in the low 20s. So it's much different in an urban area where schools have to pay teachers' salaries so they can afford to live in high-cost urban areas. And where services for the school are more expensive, where real estate is more expensive.
So that's the big driver of costs going up, is the teacher salaries.
Yeah, well, about 80% of a school's budget goes to personnel costs.
But obviously, public schools have to pay those costs as well.
That's right. They do.
Are their costs going up? I mean, obviously, you don't pay them if you're a student there, but are their costs overall going up so that taxpayers are having to spend more in order to pay teacher salaries so they can live in expensive places?
Well, there are different scales involved. So in most private independent schools, classes are small. Classes can be anywhere from 12 to 16 or 17, whereas public schools tend to have much larger classes. So there is a big saving in that. The number of teachers is much less in a public school.
Is there any evidence at this point that the rising cost of private school is driving people into public schools?
I think somewhat in certain areas. I think affordability is a big, big question for many families who might prefer to send their children to private schools but can't afford it. And also there are some very good programs in public schools that are attracting families, programs that specialize in languages, bilingual schools. There are schools that offer special math and science programs. So there are options for parents increasingly that they may not have had before.
What are some of the reasons that parents might choose to send their kids to a private school rather than a public school?
Well, I think it's an individual choice. And when I talk about independent schools, I'm really talking about a small number of private schools that tend to be college prep versus most private schools, which are affiliated with a religious group. So most private schools are religiously affiliated. A small number are what we call independent schools. And I think that's what we're talking about when we read about tuition approaching 50,000.
Those are independent schools.
Those are independent schools. Independent schools seem to attract families that are interested in a rigorous academic program. For some, their children have not succeeded in public schools. They're looking for a school that provides more individual attention, smaller classes, a smaller environment in general. The schools tend to be smaller than public schools, particularly high schools. And then for some, security, safety is an issue. For some, their children are not getting fed the rigor that they want and getting bored in their schools. It really depends on what other options there are for families. So it's both a push and pull to go to a private school, but it certainly is a big investment for most families. And affordability is a huge concern, both for the schools themselves and for families.
Have charter schools impacted the price of private schools?
So charter schools are and dictated by whatever the state decides the charter school should serve. And in some states, like Colorado, for example, charter schools serve a diverse socioeconomic group. In New York City, they were designed to serve underserved populations. I think that most states that have charter laws that allow charter schools serve these underserved populations. So if they are in a state that allows, you know, any child to attend, regardless of socioeconomic level, they do compete with independent schools.
Now, when you look at the overall attendance of public schools and private schools, both independent and religious, what are we seeing right now? Are people moving in one direction or the other?
Well, historically, about 10 to 11% of all students, K-12, have attended private schools. So that figure has more or less remained the same. If you look at private schools in general, including religiously affiliated schools, there was an increase in evangelical Christian schools, somewhat of a small decrease in independent school attendance.
I'm a product of public schools in Illinois, and I wonder what the difference is with diversity in public and private schools.
I think we have to unpack diversity. If you're talking about race and ethnicity, there probably tends to be more students of color in independent schools because the geographic area is not limited. Whereas in a public school, you know, the zip code is destiny for some, and that tends to define the diversity of the school. So if we look, for example, at a suburb of New York, Chappaqua, the number of students of color, the percentage is about 18%, versus schools in New York City, where it can be or tends to be higher, like in the 20s. And in schools that have large endowments, for example, Andover and Exeter, the number of students of color is approaching 50%. But diversity is defined differently when one looks at the socioeconomic factors. Socioeconomic diversity is really key to bringing students from different kinds of families together and preparing them to live in the society, which is going to be increasingly diverse, both in color, race, and ethnicity, as well as socioeconomically.
And socioeconomically, what are we seeing between public and private schools right now?
It depends on the area. You know, in some areas like Newport Beach, if you can spend a couple of million for a house, then the public schools there are probably more homogeneous than, you know, an independent school, which can also offer financial aid. And the schools are increasingly doing that.
When somebody comes to you, a friend, let's say, and says, I'm trying to decide whether to send my child to public school or private school, what do you say to that person? What kind of information would you offer?
I would ask, you know, tell me about your child. Why are you considering this? The schools at one point, not in the early beginnings, were attracting some families that wanted the social status of attending an independent school. But that reason is declining. If anything, the focus on any kind of elitism is the quality of the academic program. So I think we're seeing different populations of families and what they want, and the realization that for their children to get ahead in the world, the more diverse the school and their preparation in that kind of environment, the better they are prepared to be, you know, leaders in society.
But not many people are going to be able to afford to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to send their children to private school K-12.
I think, yeah, it's a huge, huge decision. And for some, it means, you know, rethinking how they spend money. For example, how they live, where they live. So a lot of families have chosen, you know, to make that sacrifice. But for most families, it is a big challenge, and they need to feel that they're making a decision that will affect their child, you know, for the long term. I think that's why parents choose private schools. Or they move to areas where they feel the schools will meet the needs of their child.
That's Pearl Kane, a professor and the director of the Klingenstein Center at Teachers College at Columbia University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure.
The mass shooting in Las Vegas has added new urgency to the gun control debate, and that will likely invigorate groups like the Three Percenters Militia, which staunchly defends gun ownership. Militia groups have recently become much more visible, and Three Percenters have been showing up at political demonstrations dressed for battle. It's a relatively new tactic for this militia, and one that's causing a stir. Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
A social justice protest in the heart of Kansas City in August drew several hundred people, but many seemed distracted. Will Jones, for instance, kept looking nervously over his shoulder towards a couple dozen people dressed in camo, armed with guns, knives, and bulletproof vests.
Well, I'm just looking at the white supremacists, whoever they are up there with their guns. You know, I'm just curious what they're up to and just glancing at everyone once in a while.
It was Jones' first brush with the Missouri Three Percenters Militia. The name comes from the legend that only 3% of the population actually fought in the Revolutionary War, idea being that a small armed force can have a big influence. But to Amanda Veen, the 3%ers look more like an invading army.
Well, they came with guns, so I came with a baseball bat. If they attack us, I mean, we have to do something. I'm not just going to sit by and let it happen.
But militia leaders insist they're not out for trouble.
We stand for anybody's right, First Amendment right. We weren't there to counter-protest. We just wanted to make sure that nobody got hurt.
Robert Malcolm is state spokesman for the Missouri Three Percenters, and he wants it understood that the militia is not siding with white supremacists. In fact, he says, racism in his militia is strictly forbidden.
By law number 5, our brothers and sisters are of all races, colors, and creeds. Any comments or actions of a racial tone are made, the violator shall be expelled from the group and blocked from ever joining again.
Now, there's nothing stopping wannabes from just dressing up and playing militia, and there's lots of little militia groups, so it's messy. But as a rule, real members of organized right-wing militias tend to have a few things in common. Most are big on gun rights, prepping for social collapse, and a strict interpretation of the Constitution. A lot of them take a dim view of Muslims. And Malcolm says they do not like Nazis.
We stand against the alt-right. just as much as we stand against the alt-left, I guess you could call it. We're not extremists.
And historically, militias have not been all that political. They mostly kept to themselves, training in the woods and such. This being out in public at protests is a fairly new thing. And Malcolm says it's all about free speech.
The First Amendment is more in peril than at any time in our existence as a nation.
And as far as Malcolm is concerned, that existential threat to one of our fundamental freedoms comes chiefly from a small group of protesters on the left.
Antifa makes it quite clear the only opinion is their opinion.
But some see the militia as the ones menacing free speech. A Kansas City area teenager named Andy organized that recent rally where the 3%ers showed up. Andy doesn't want her name used because she's afraid of reprisals, but she says the militia presence felt ominous.
It was definitely very intimidating, very brooding. It wasn't a, wow, I feel really protected by these people being here. It was a, I really hope they don't shoot me.
And that fear sparked calls to prohibit people from openly carrying weapons at demonstrations. But Kansas City Mayor Sly James, a Democrat, says the city's hands are tied.
Well, first of all, you can't say no guns at protests because it's a Second Amendment right, and the state of Missouri has decided that anybody can have a gun at any time, damn near any place.
So get used to seeing armed militia at political rallies. But what are they really doing there? Professor Don Heider-Markell says it may have less to do with protecting or intimidating protesters and more to do with bolstering their own organizations.
A new lease on life, for sure, for militia groups.
Heider-Markell says Trump's election victory hurt the militias. Many militia members, he says, saw Obama as a peril to democracy. With him and Hillary Clinton out of the way, there was little to mobilize against. Then came the post-election protests, the fights over Confederate monuments, the violence in Charlottesville. Heider-Markell says angry protesters on the left sharpened the militia's sense of purpose.
If anything, it sort of feeds into the arguments that groups like the militia groups, the NRA, the current administration is trying to make, that this left is dangerous. It's not just their ideas are dangerous. They're actually dangerous in the streets, and they're confirming it.
But militia groups also confirm liberal fears. And Heider-Markell says that when militias show up at protests, they're lumped in with white supremacists.
I think it is a risky strategy for them, especially since they have struggled consistently to get rid of this label that they're just sort of recreated Klansmen and neo-Nazis.
Heider-Markell says that real militia members have done a pretty good job of staying neutral so far. That doesn't ease the minds of protesters. They tend to see the militia as provocateurs rather than peacemakers. For Here and Now, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.